Welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, a weekly podcast from Hobeck Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, mystery, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of running a creative business in this challenging world. We'll hear from the people who make this possible, the authors, the cover designers and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on the Hobcast Book Show from Hobeck Books, as we combine trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
And welcome to the Hobcast Book Show, episode number 165. My name is Adrian Hobart.
My name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hobeck Books, UK independent publishers, of the following four genres.
Thrillers.
Mysteries.
Suspense.
And crime, in no particular order.
Well, it never is any in any particular order. Although there's only so many ways you can vary it.
That's true.
12, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, it's been an amazing week this week. We have been super, super mega busy. But we ought to mention that coming up in the show, we have a great interview with Stacey Murray, who is a Hobeck author. And her first title for us is published on Tuesday.
The 19th of March.
And it's The Thief of Joy, a domestic noir, psychological suspense. And it is solidly based in the Derbyshire Dales, around the Buxton area and the edges of Manchester.
Yeah.
An area I know very well. I've lived there for 12 years.
I think it will make people want to go there because it's very much, place is very important in this book.
It is. And it, you know, but it has a number of universal themes, which we will explore with Stacey a little bit later in the show. But what a week we've had. We have been on our travels, including a visit to a certain venue in West London, which was teeming with book types. Hello.
Hello.
Guess where we are?
London Book Fair.
Look at the scale of this. This is Olympia in London, and we're at London Book Fair. Slightly overwhelmed as ever when
we
get here.
Like, it's full of books that you can't take away. It's full of people who know about books, and they're all very...
Yes. But very powerful. Lots of powerful walking going on.
Lots of powerful walking, but the hubbub, the noise, that sort of background chatter I love. It's like things are happening and deals are being done.
Yes.
Ideas exchanged and
that. Would that they were being done by us. Not yet so far, but we'll see.
Yeah, we need coffee first.
We'll bring you more action from Author HQ, which is that way, in
a
moment.
Pink carpet up there.
Absolutely. It's an overwhelming experience, isn't it, the LBF?
Yes, absolutely. Teeming with book types, totally. Lots of Tarquins and Matildas.
What I loved, there was a little vignette was when we walked up towards Olympia, and there was this scene where a lady who was, she was statuesque, I mean, she was tall, 6 foot something, two, three maybe, and she spotted someone that she'd worked with before.
Yeah, so...
And one of the things when you're approaching Olympia is that you have to go in one of those ridiculous crowd control...
A bit like Alton Towers.
Yeah, you're zigzagging before you get to the entrance, even though there were very few people actually trying to get in at that point at 11 o'clock on a Thursday morning, and they could have just lifted a couple of barriers to make it all very quick. They didn't. And so there she's going, oh, my God, it's you!
That sounds like Robert Dawes.
Well... No, I'm sorry, Bob. We didn't really mean that. But yeah, it was, oh my God, how long has it been? And this poor bloke who went stiffened visibly, gave the most lukewarm of hugs to the lady who was greeting him.
Do you know what's interesting, though?
Where are you working now?
I picked up enough from that little conversation that somebody listening to this podcast who works in publishing will probably know exactly who it is. She used to work at DK. She also used to work at Bloomsbury. Now works for a little publisher called Magic Cat. And that probably is enough to pinpoint who this person is.
It probably is. But anyway, I mean, he stiffened and it was as lukewarm a hug as you could possibly have.
oh, we must catch up.
Well, and I hope he's not listening.
He was incredibly silent at all this. So goodness knows what happened either at Bloomsbury or DK for this relationship to be quite as frosty.
Well, there are many things. Like, he could be very introverted. He could be overwhelmed. He could have had an awful journey.
He could be all sorts of things.
They could have had a little, and it went wrong or anything.
Well, really, now we're really extrapolating. But that's what you and I do. We sit on trains and we imagine the lives of everybody. But that was a great vignette. Anyway, the event itself was super busy, and very noticeably, there were many more pockets of areas where deals were being done, more so than the previous ones I've been to, in terms of agents' desks and things like that. So there was a lot of that going on. The layout is incredibly familiar. If you ever go to the LBF, you won't be lost for long, because there's very few new exhibitors in very, few different places. They're all in the same places, especially in the big hall. It starts off with HarperCollins and Penguin Random House right at the front, sort of like twin towers of Mammon, with these incredible displays and, video screens everywhere and all that sort of thing.
Yes, and people at desks within their little areas where you dare not tread.
Yes.
I so badly want to just walk in confidently and see if anyone approaches me. Maybe next year I'll try that.
Yeah, I don't think we give the confidence vibe off.
Yeah, but you can fake it, can't you?
Yeah, well, yes, that would be some fakery. But then you get sort of the national stands, like France and Germany have equally sized ones, sort of eyeing each other across the aisle. And therefore, and it goes on like that. And then there's the agents' fair, which is at the far end of the main hall. But on the mezzanine above, on the first floor, overlooking things, is where you get children's. And then you get to Author HQ, which is the independent authors and independent publishers area.
The pink carpet bit.
And we went up there, spent some time there, and people we knew, we said we were going to say hello to Barry Hutchinson. In fact, he disappeared before
he was chatting. He was so busy chatting to people.
We didn't want to interrupt.
Same with Rachel.
And Rachel McLean was there. And obviously we saw a bit of her this week, because we'll talk all about that. We went to Dorset with her. So that's all very well and good. But they do have a lot of interesting talks in Author Central HQ, whatever they call it. And we sat in one which was about the influence of TikTok or BookTok on publishing. And while one aspect of it was a little disappointing, I didn't come away any clearer understanding of how to harness BookTok and TikTok to drive sales.
No, but it wasn't really about that.
It was the people talking were three creators who have built a big influence and profile on BookTok, but they didn't really talk about how they've done it. I mean, it just sort of still seems to be an elusive concept, especially for people of our generation. But there was a little throwaway comment, a question that was thrown to the panel, which totally threw them. And this is news this week, which I now report from, if I can find my phone, from the BBC. So in the United States, the process of legislation started to ban TikTok before the end of the year in the United States. And this is principally because TikTok is a Chinese company, parent company, with very close links to the Chinese Communist Party. And one of the things that people are worried about in the United States is that TikTok could influence the election and this would be Chinese influence on the outcome of the US presidential election in November. And they, let's have a look at this. They passed a landmark bill in the US House of Representatives this week, which could see TikTok banned in the United States.
Blimey. I mean, that would be huge. Because the United States is huge.
Absolutely. So it would give the social media giant's Chinese parent company ByteDance 6 months to sell its controlling stake, or the app would be blocked in the US. So essentially they're trying to sever that Chinese influence and control in the United States specifically, or it gets shut down.
Permanent though, or just in the run-up to the election?
No, permanent. It passed overwhelmingly, this bill, in a bipartisan vote. It still needs to clear the Senate, so there's still a battle to go on, and be signed by the president to become law. Lawmakers have long held concerns about China's influence over TikTok. It was founded in 2012 by ByteDance. And the Beijing-based firm is registered in the Cayman Islands and has offices across the US and Europe. And if the bill does manage to secure approval in the Senate, President Joe Biden has promised to sign it as soon as it lands on his desk, which could prompt a diplomatic spat with China.
Yes. Can you imagine if TikTok causes a war?
Well, yeah. Strange things have happened. TikTok has tried to reassure regulators that it has taken steps to ensure the data of its 150 million users in the US has been walled off from ByteDance employees in China. Anyway, well, I mean, that's one side of it. But what would happen if TikTok was shut down in the United States and the three creators on the panel were going, I try not to think about it. You know, most of my viewers are in America, and that's where the most of their audience is. And it would have an unbelievable and very sudden impact on book discoverability through BookTok and therefore sales, because that's where a lot of publishers have put their efforts in to gaining reviews from TikTok influencers. And that's where they're making their money, because they're paid to review books, quite a lot of them. Not always. You know, there will be some organic reach there, but it would have an you know, just like BookTok has had a very sudden and sort of disproportionate impact on book sales, and things like Colleen Hoover, her sudden repopularity is around the influence of BookTok. Take that away, and suddenly that's part of the marketing ecosystem stripped out.
But it's not taking it away completely, because I don't think TikTok would cease to exist. It would just skew the impact away from the US, obviously.
Yeah, but that's where its principal user base is. And in terms of its, you know, it wouldn't totally shut it down, clearly. But are the Chinese and its parent company, ByteDance, prepared to sell off their interest in their own company? Because if the US says so, it's going to be fascinating. So let's watch that space in the next 6 months. But that has, you know, it's a really, really interesting story about nationalism and about the impact of social media in the marketplace. And it could be, you know, it's very interesting. So let's watch that.
The impact of social media on politics, which, you know... 10, 15 years ago wouldn't have been such an issue.
No, indeed. So we'll watch that one with interest. And then another story emerged from London Book Fair, which we've just been delving into, which is the announcement, without any detail yet. So
It's a bit of a woolly announcement.
It's a woolly announcement. It's a kind of soft announcement, but it's from Audible, which, as you all know, is the audio branch of Amazon, particularly making money from audiobooks. And indeed, quite a number of my narrations have been exclusively done for clients who then put it on Audible exclusively. And indeed, if you publish wide, as we have done in the past with Findaway Voices or indeed any of the other aggregators, they'll go to Audible as well. But one of the biggest criticisms of the Audible model is just how little of the revenue goes to the people who created the audiobooks, the people who wrote them and the people who narrated them.
Mm-hmm.
And as it stands, the structure is this. If you are exclusive with Audible, i.e. you're not on Google Play or Apple Books.
So is that the equivalent of being in Kindle Unlimited?
Yeah, essentially, yeah. You get 40% of the royalties.
Right.
And that's based on the credit system, isn't it?
Which is a lot less than an ebook.
Yes. Yes. It's a lot cheaper. You know, one, if your book is the one that somebody buys with a credit, the revenue that Audible take is $7.95. And in theory you'd get 40% of that. If you're not exclusive,
it's gonna be less, isn't it?
It's 25%.
Yeah.
Now, it turns out that Lee Jarrett, who's head of ACX and North American Publisher Partnerships at Audible, said that Audible will be launching a new royalty model with the aim of creating a more equitable and insightful system. Now, you get absolutely zero user data from Audible to of any use when you signed up with them. I mean, you don't even get the sort of limited stuff you get in KDP.
Well, you don't get, no, there's no dashboard as such, is
there? Not really, no. It's sort of, you know, downloads. And then if somebody hands it back in within a week, you know, you end up paying for the credit back to them. So they have announced some changes, and Jarrett said that more details will be unveiled in due course. And the first hint that this was happening came from American science fiction and fantasy author Brandon Sanderson, who is a massive news in indie publishing, made millions on things like Kickstarter. He did a package where it would be, you know, he's producing his books in vellum, you know.
Oh, not typesetting vellum, but actual old-fashioned vellum.
Yeah, yeah. And he made $7 million converting one of his...
Why have I never heard of him?
Well, I mean, it's one of those things. It's not an area of genre that we're particularly interested in, I suppose.
What was the genre again?
Science fiction and fantasy.
Oh, okay.
He's been vocal about his concerns regarding Audible's royalties, especially for independent authors. And then wrote about, last week, a new royalty structure they intend to offer to independent writers and smaller publishers. And he previously held back four of his books from Audible.
Wow.
because of his feeling that they were screwing people over. So, there we go. We know something's coming. We don't know what it is.
No.
I have no doubt that this is part of the response to Spotify's move into the marketplace.
Absolutely.
They also announced this week on Audible, and it was in the national press, that they are offering new subscribers the chance to have 3 months access to Audible for just 99p.
Wow.
I mean, you know, what that means for creators in terms of how much you might get paid for your audiobooks, I don't know. But they're obviously spooked by Spotify's big time move.
Mm.
And as we've discussed, what Spotify are offering is 15 hours per month of audiobook content if you're a premium subscriber. So that's if you get everything, the music, now 15 hours of audiobooks without any extra cost. So that was their big move, which spooked Amazon.
Well, yes. I mean, and I was just thinking, I learned about this in economics. It's when you have, it's not a monopoly, but it's, what's it called? Oligopoly, where you have a few big companies, two or three big companies.
Yep.
One company makes a move and the other two
follow. Well, it's like the supermarket price wars.
Exactly that. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. And so there's a lot of shift there. But the thing is that, as ever with, you know, if there's a supermarket war, it's always the people who produce the milk and the eggs and whatever else who are squeezed and actually end up being paid less than it costs to make things. And in a sense, that's what I'm worried about. But if there is a long-term effort to pay more to creators, and I think Audible have underpaid people hugely. But don't forget, you see, if you're in KDP with books, you're most of the time you're getting a 70% royalty on the cover price.
Mm.
You're not getting that in audiobook terms. You're not getting a fraction of it. So,
but it's interesting why no one's questioned that much.
Well, they have, and the thing is, Audible lived for years on the assumption that they were the only place to go. We won't be doing it in the future with Findaway because they've been messing people about, as we've said before. But there are 42 different ways or platforms, but only two or three really generate the income. And that is libraries, Spotify, Audible, and Google Play, and the rest of them, Apple Books as well, to some extent.
But
I mean, the realistically, most of the others don't really generate anything.
No.
So you're still stuck with an oligopoly going on in audiobooks. But it's interesting times. I think that, you know, there's no question they've been absolutely taking the mickey when it comes to royalty rates on Audible for the whole time.
Mm.
And, you know, what do you do? Because I think there are beginning to be alternative opportunities for you to self-direct your audiobooks, which I think is the way forward. And clearly that's the other thing that we take away from our visit to London Book Fair, we went to a session with Book Vault, and we indeed had a chat with them, and they are a public-facing element of a much bigger publishing and printing system. But what they're offering for independent authors and independent publishers like us is an opportunity to produce books of with higher, greater features.
Yes, exactly. There's more variety in what you can do with Book Vault.
Right, which you can't do with some of the other public printers that we use at the moment. So you can produce higher quality books in terms of the way they're presented, and you can ship them direct. So the customer orders off your website, it goes through to Book Vault. Book Vault then do the shipping, which is something that we currently have to do physically most of the time from our own kitchen. So that's another thing that's really appealing. And the variety of what you can offer the customer in future. So that was, you know, selling direct is a big theme in independent publishing at the moment, and something that we are going to undoubtedly move into this year.
We are pursuing, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing I like about Book Vault, it's interesting to see if Ingram Spark react to the rise of Book Vault, whether they start offering multiple formats and better deals in that oligarchy way, because there aren't many opportunities.
Oligopoly.
Did I say oligarchy?
Yes, you did.
Oligopoly way. You know what I mean? They are bound to have to do something because they will lose business.
And indeed, the other printers. I mean, we use Clays for the...
Well, Clays do all those special things.
They do all that, but it's been, you know, it's not cost effective to do it as a print run because it's too expensive. So if you're talking about doing, you know, hardback editions with sprayed edges and a ribbon in the middle and all that sort of thing.
Oh, it'd have to be print on demand, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
us?
You can do it print on demand now. And that is the difference.
Yeah.
So you can encourage your super fan, readers, if they want something, you know, a little bit different with bookend papers and all that sort of stuff that really elevates a book to something, an object of desire.
It turns into an object, yeah.
That can be done, and it can be done print on demand, and that is a huge change. So we will be shifting that way. It's going to take a lot of work. Got to build a new shop front and all that sort of thing, and supply systems, and figure out how it's all done. But there's no question, it's appealing to us.
Oh, absolutely! I cannot wait to the time when I don't have to, which I'm going to have to do for Monday. I've got to wrap up about. I've got to send a big box of books to Lynn LaVersha because she's doing some events in May, but also single books to various people who've ordered books, pre-ordered The Thief of Joy, but also I'm sending review copies. I won't have to do any of that if we use Book Vault.
Yeah, that's the future. So that's an exciting element. And the other exciting thing we did at London Book Fair was we caught up with someone we've mentioned before, Pineapple Man. Mr. Pineapple Man was there. And he had a huge stand. I mean, it rivaled some of the major publishers.
Every year, his stand gets bigger. And I think 10 years from now, watch out, HarperCollins, because the Pineapple Man's coming to get you.
Well, it's just the most incredible sign of his drive to get his message out there. I'm not quite sure what that message is.
You listened to him for 20 minutes.
Well, we did, yes. And here is 30 seconds of him talking about his latest release, which is due to come out later this year, which will encompass everything he's learnt about life.
And pineapples.
And pineapples.
This book will finally answer the big question. Mr. Pineapple, why the pineapple?
Yes.
What should we know about the pineapple fruit? So this book is an all-in-one. It will be a high-quality book like never before. You can use it as a nice home decor also at home. It will be the history, my research history of the pineapple since the 1400s. It will be a travel book because everywhere I go, I find pineapple attractions that people don't know about. London is full of them.
Oh, really?
Because my project started here in London.
One of the great eccentrics and one of the nicest people you'll meet at London Book Fair.
I love, though, I don't think this is in the recording, though, when I asked him, what is the Japanese for pineapple? And it was clear he didn't know.
And he said, I believe it's pineapple. Well, anyway,
I'm going to look it up later because I don't think it is.
We're going to get him on the show once at some time, and you know we all look forward to that. But I just, having spoken to him for quite a few minutes for a second time in my life, I still didn't quite know what it was he's trying to philosophically pass on to the rest of the world.
Were you aware of the conversation I had with the security guy before we approached Pineapple Man?
I was aware that you were talking to him, but I don't know what was in it.
The security guard overheard me say to you, I wonder if he knows the Japanese for pineapple. And the security guard, without changing his expression, because he was doing his job, he didn't even look at me. He was looking around and he just said, I bet he does. And I said, do you think I should ask him? The security guard, without looking at me again, said, you should do. I think he does.
He was like Keith from The Office.
He was. So I did ask him, and his answer surprised me because I didn't think he would just say, oh, they say pineapple.
Okay. Well, that sort of rounds up our review of London Book Fair 2024. Plenty came out of it. Let's get to our interview now with Stacey Murray. Stacey is a Hoback author. She joined us a few months ago, and The Thief of Joy is her first novel with us. And it is a terrific, modern, domestic noir, psychological suspense, which, you know, puts the main character, Roz, in all sorts of situations that essentially you can empathise with because, you know, if she makes mistakes, they're based on, you know, honest misinterpretations or desires which take her into places where she should, you know, she'd be unwise to go.
Yes.
But her judgment is impaired because she's just not happy with life.
Yeah, and it's all just as we all are. We all do these things. So it's a very relatable story.
Totally. Now, I ought to say, this interview we conducted last week, Zoom was not our friend this week. So this is an edited version where we've taken out all the bits where it fell off. You know, we fell off.
Yeah, we lost connection quite a lot.
And we will be picking up with the back end of the random question.
Because it's gold, so we can't miss it.
It is. So let's... It's a delight to speak to Stacey Murray. This is what it's all about, Rebecca. Because I'm holding, for those who can't see it, I'm holding The Thief of Joy by Stacey Murray, who joins us on the Hobcast. But this is the point where it's really exciting when you've actually got the book in front of you. And it's sometimes easy to forget just how much work goes into it.
Well, they thought she'd publish it. So, no, we've got one.
Yeah, but it will be very, very soon. Stacey, thank you for joining us and congratulations. It's a great book.
Thank you very much for having me. And it's great to see the book being brandished.
I'm conscious that that is stock, so I'm going to look after it very tenderly.
That's it. Yeah.
You can't, you know, don't leave any thumbprints and don't bend anything and don't fold any pages because
that's it. Yeah, it's a treasure.
the reason for that is we've had a good number of pre-orders. So every copy we have at the moment, I think, is earmarked for somebody on Tuesday. So.
That's it. Hold on to it, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, look, it's your first book with us and we're enormously gratified that you wanted to join us, and we were thrilled when we read it and we've got to this point. So it's an awful question because, you know, you're talking to us.
That's a question, but it's an awful question.
It's an awful question, but I mean, how does it feel as we approach publication day for you? How this whole process, how's it been for you?
It's been quite exciting. I mean, there's always a little bit of nerves about when a new book comes out, and you know, you want people to like it and that sort of thing. But I think it's been pretty exciting. It's been an interesting process leading up to this point. And yeah, you do forget sort of how long it's been going on from, you know, the first idea right up until where we are now. But I think it's been very enjoyable and it's been collaborative and it's been a good experience.
Well, that's really good to hear. And, you know, it's something that we hope is always the case. It isn't always. But, of course, there are always these elements where at certain stages of the process, there's a debate. The cover, you know, is always an area of single debate, isn't it?
I think a lot of the time authors and publishers put more effort into the cover
the content.
Yes. No, I mean, I think, yeah, you do that. There will always be some issues that will come up to be sort of resolved or whatever. But I suppose in a way, that's the fun part, isn't it? Is sort of thinking it through, thinking how best to go forward with these things. Because, at the time, you might feel like, oh, what shall we do? Shall we do this or do that? But in looking back, you often think that was the most enjoyable bit, having sort of thrashing out it's the creative process, really, isn't it?
I love it. I also like when there's a sort of a slight disagreement, and then you look at the other person's perspective and you think, actually, they've got a point, or the other way around, what they might say to you, that they think there's something in what you're saying.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, in a way, a cover is, when you start out, you think all things are possible. And then gradually,
Yeah.
certain limitations creep in, and they can include, and we ought to say, give credit to Jane Mapp for this wonderful cover.
Absolutely.
Another brilliant cover, Jane. Thank you for that. Now, I know we debated quite a lot of time about the house that features on the cover here, with the glow of the lights.
And whether to have a figure and all those sorts of
Yeah,
decisions.
but I mean, getting the house right was a big one, wasn't it? Because you go on stock images, and there are
Oh.
gazillion images of houses that could make a cover, but
Yeah.
they immediately give away where they're from. I look at it and I think that looks like it's in Derbyshire to me.
It's great. Yeah, no, Jane did a fantastic job with the cover. I'm really, really pleased with it.
And then there's things like, I mean, we debate this all the time, the font, all the
Yeah.
fonts, portals.
I love it. I love the detail of this. You can talk about fonts all day long. I'm happy.
Now, what is within the book is the question, really, the thief of joy. So let's delve into the world of Roz, who is the protagonist in this brilliant book. Perhaps you could describe, her scenario in the sense, and I think this would be one that's familiar to a lot of people, but essentially she's looking for love and she thinks she's found it, and then it's torn away from her.
Yeah, she's someone at a stage in life. She's a single mum on her own at 39, looking around at everyone else whose life seemed to be completely sorted, especially her sister, who's doing extremely well for herself as a lawyer with a lovely family, with a lovely home. Her best friend, who's sort of living the high life in London, and Roz sort of looks at herself and thinks, "Oh God, is this it?" She's still living in the town, which is Buxton in Derbyshire, in the Peak District, where she grew up. And she's looking around and sort of thinking, "Is this it?" And then this person comes into her life, Daniel, and she thinks, "Oh, great, this is kind of the answer to my prayers. He's perfect for me." And then he is sort of snatched from her early doors, which kind of plunges her into a scenario where she's kind of thinking, "Oh God, what now?" And sort of grasping at what's around. And that's kind of where the story kicks off from. That's the jumping off point.
I mean, in a sense, everything that happens to her seems to confirm her own biased view of her own life, which is surely this isn't what I'm destined to be like and be surrounded by and all this sort of thing. Although let's not run Buxton down. It's one of my favorite
Oh
places.
yeah, that's one of the reasons why I chose it, because I often visit there, and I like it, and it's quite a dramatic place. It's surrounded by lots of dramatic countryside, and I like that. I personally like, so I thought I quite fancy writing about something that I'll enjoy writing about, really. And I think the other thing to say about Roz's situation is that she suffers from something which I think a lot of people maybe suffer from at different times in life, and that is what I've heard described as the curse of comparison, where she kind of
Yes.
looks at everyone else's life and thinks, "Oh, look at their life's better than my sister, my friend." And I go on social media, celebrities are doing this, this is what. So all of this adds to her feelings of, God, you know, inadequacy, and her disaffection with her life. So I kind of, and that was something that I've kind of noticed a lot, I thought would be interesting to write about, to explore that sort of, people look at the outside of everyone else's life and assume that it's great and that, oh, I wish I had, maybe was more like that, or maybe I was more like that, or like her, or like him. And sometimes the reality is quite different. So I just thought that was quite interesting territory for a book, and to get into some of that. And even in subjects like grief, when someone has lost someone, people can be competitive with other people's grief, saying, well, yes, you know, well, you were, I was married longer than you, well, you didn't know him very long, or you did, you know, your situation, my situation is worse than yours, or I'm more entitled to feel like this than you are. And I think all that competitiveness and comparison, I just found really interesting from a psychological point of view.
Yeah. And there's also that sort of sense that she feels that she's just blighted by bad luck, even though she isn't really, but she sort of focuses on the bad things that happen to her and saying, oh, that's just because I'm always going to have bad luck.
Yes.
And I actually had a friend in a sort of similar situation. She was a single mum of four children, though, so a few more than Roz, but she was constantly, I'll never find anybody because I've got four children, or because I'm so busy. She was almost sort of focusing on all the negatives and thinking, well, this is, I'm blighted to be like this. And it's all right for you. You've got a partner. It's all right for that person. They've got a lovely house, or that person's got a great job. And but actually, life isn't like that, is it? And this friend, for example, did find someone, and she's now happily with the partner, and everything's wonderful. But
for a long time,
she saw her future, and she almost wrote her future herself.
It's definitely human nature always to focus on what's wrong rather than what's right. It's like, you know, Johnny Wilkinson, the rugby player, you know, talking about when he was practicing kicks, and you know, he'd do 100 that would go over, but it always afterwards in training, focusing on the one, you know, the one that didn't go, you know, what, why was that, you know? And I do think that is human nature. And certainly Roz is someone who can't see what is good about her life or what's positive about it.
But within that context, then life turns a little bit darker for Roz. I don't want to give too much away.
Yes, yeah.
Maybe it's partly, it's that thing of being impatient, I suppose. So because of her impatience, she doesn't make the best decisions for herself.
I think when Daniel dies, who was the sort of, as she saw it, might be the perfect answer to her prayers and make everything all right with her life. She's in a vulnerable position at that point, and starts to go down a bit of a dangerous road, maybe unthinking, or, you know, she's turning a blind eye, trying not to think about certain things that she shouldn't be doing. Yeah, I don't want to give too many spoilers, or if it's a problem to say what she does, because it probably is a bit of a problem to go any further and see what she does.
Well, people will just have to read to find out, won't they?
Exactly. Yeah. And
but I think you're picking up on a very powerful modern theme, and I think that I wrote this on Facebook about 2 weeks ago, where someone was writing about, this is a bit darker, I suppose, but they were prompted by two of their friends who they hadn't seen for ages, committing suicide within a week. And I wrote something along the lines of, you know, we've never had greater ease of communication, but less contact and less communication, if you know what I mean. So lots of, we're talking over Zoom, didn't exist, you know, 10 years ago. We're in constant contact with what's going on through our phones and whatever. But actually, all of that just makes us feel more isolated. And I think that social media in particular is a whole load. Occasionally, I mean, it was an unusual post in the sense it was very, very honest about, you know, asking the question, what's going on, in the context of two friends committing suicide. But you know, most of the time, 90% of the stuff that's out there is either egregiously sort of show-offy and look at me, I've got this, it's how dare you have that, I hate you, and therefore being trolled. It does amplify what Roz is feeling.
There's a lot out there that's not authentic, and, you know, that there's... In Roz's life, a lot of the posts that she sees or the contact she sees or has with friends, a lot of it is that kind of show-offy kind of stuff, which is making her feel even worse. And actually, you've reminded me in saying that one of the other things that I kind of wanted to explore with the book was the fact that, you know, loneliness is quite a big topic in society at the moment as well. And Roz is quite lonely. When she comes home from work at night and she's home with her young daughter, who she loves absolutely and unconditionally, but she is a lonely person, and that is also a part of what makes her do some of the things that she does and perhaps override her common sense in certain circumstances as well. And because I think that kind of thing can corrode your judgment, really, maybe.
We talked about setting briefly, so Buxton being the sort of principal setting. One of the things I loved when I read your submission was how brilliantly you evoke areas that I know well, because until relatively recently, I lived only a few miles from where you are in the Hope Valley in Derbyshire, and I was in Disley, which is, you know, as you approach Stockport, but still sort of in the foothills, I think, of the Peak District. It has a very peak feel to it.
It's always raining.
But also, you know, when you go into the, you know, you write about going into areas of Manchester and that I know well. I think you've captured it really well.
Thank you.
and it is that thing about where you are in particular. The Hope Valley is gorgeous. It is absolutely gorgeous. But it's encircled, isn't it? Because you've got ridges over the, you know, surrounding you. And in the winter, I love the stone in that area. But when it gets wet, it gets very dark, doesn't it? You know, it has a certain closed-in feel.
It's cloudy. It's always cloudy.
Yeah, no, well, that's not true. I've cycled on some beautiful days through there, and the daffodils are out and all that sort of thing.
I mean, yeah, but on a rainy day, the clouds are closer.
Yeah, but Buxton in particular feels cut off in a way. You know, it takes a long time to get there from anywhere.
It's very high. I mean, I think there's always a little bit of a debate, but I think it's generally regarded as the highest sort of market town in England.
Right.
And it sometimes snows in June. You know, and that was one of the things that I quite liked, or one of the reasons I fancied setting the book there, because I think it was kind of dramatic and perhaps fed into Roz's state of mind a little bit. And also for me, I mean, speaking personally, I have to say, a dyed-in-the-wool townie, even though I've lived here a long time now. So there is something of the... I mean, I moved to Hong Kong in my 20s from London, where a lot of people got culture shock in Hong Kong, and I didn't really. Whereas when I moved to the Hope Valley, and which is close to where I live, which is close to Buxton, I had massive, massive culture shock. And I think it might be something I'm trying to resolve through writing about it as well. You know, so there might be an element of me in there. I don't know.
Yeah. The question for you, Stacey, really is do you feel the call of the urban environment and the city again? Is that calling to you, or are you happy where you are, or are you thinking of other options, or I don't know?
No, I wonder, you know, I think it's a good question, but I think my brain plasticity has changed now, and I do love the countryside, actually, now, and I love being out, and I didn't used to know what anything was, you know, plants, birds, or apart from the main ones, you know, and Now I quite love all that, and my little dog, who I often have rescue dogs, who's my little muse, who's lying next to me as I'm talking to you. You know, we go out and walk and, you know, think about plots and that kind of thing, and naughty writing type author issues. And yeah, I like the space of being outside, and I like, climbing hills, and I've actually become really quite hearty. And I'm not quite sure how I would handle going back into the urban environment now. So it's taken a long time to get used to it, but I'd say it was probably worth it.
You're a lawyer.
Yes, I was a corporate
How much
lawyer
is how
and
much
licensed.
a corporate lawyer? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're talking about, brain plasticity. That role requires enormous buckets of it, doesn't it?
It was absolutely great fun. I mean, I love doing the job, for lots of reasons, which is, you got to travel the world and meet lots of interesting people. And but yeah, you do have to be quite on top. You have to be quite on top of things, and especially if you're sort of running a deal, or you have to be well organized and used to dealing with vast amounts of paper and, negotiating. Just there's a lot in it. There's someone once described it as being like a ringmaster. It's a little bit like that, yeah. And a
Yes.
lot of it is quite, it has, where, especially if you're working on deals which involve pulling things together for a number of different countries and jurisdictions, you have to kind of think, how will what I'm doing here in this jurisdiction affect what's happening in Thailand or, Ethiopia? You're trying to kind of pull it all together, and it's a bit like the writing process, and if you sort of change one thing or amend one thing, I always think of it as amendments, even to this day. If I amend this, how does this, what knock-on effects does this have, sort of 9, 10 moves down the line? So it's actually, I suppose, quite a useful background to have for a writer, I think, because you're used to
It
trying
does
to.
sound like it.
Well, in a sense,
It's a
yeah.
big chess game.
Well, yeah, I think that's very interesting. I mean, in a sense, you've got to be on top of all of the detail. But then, when you're a lawyer like that, you probably have to disseminate the thing that's valuable to the person that you're speaking to, while keep retaining the bigger picture, which is really what writing a book is about, because you've got the bigger story. But what you leave in is and what you leave out is just as important. And therefore thinking about what's the most pertinent information for the reader at any given time. So that is fascinating. And yet, so would you describe yourself, this is the old chestnut here,
Go on then.
plosser or pantser?
We haven't asked that for ages.
No, we haven't
That
actually.
doesn't,
You're right.
that's a very easy one. Yeah, definitely a plotter. I like to kind of have a good old think about things before I start. But having said all of that, I have changed things, including with this book or anything I'm writing. I think you've got to be alive to the chance, which happens often, that some new idea, some better idea, will crop up while you're in the process. And I know it sounds corny when authors say it, but when the character surprises you, it does something that you weren't expecting. And I think that I wouldn't want to shut myself off from anything like that. So I'm quite happy to change course as I go along. But for me, it helps me to know that I'm going in a vague direction when I start, and roughly where the end point is.
Yeah, so it's having a balance, isn't it? It's almost like you would want plasticity.
Plasticity.
Plasticity. So plot plasticity.
Yes. But I mean, to me as well, because I used to, I worked for a time as an independent film producer. And I think,
Yes.
and so screenwriting kind of helped with that as well, because if it's a feature film, obviously you've got to prepare, the story has to keep going, it has to go forward all the time. And also, I mean, to me, everything starts with character. So if you've got a good character, so before I start, I spend a lot of time thinking about who is this person or people in terms of the main character or characters. That's massively important, because I sort of think you want to feel that you know this person, but also the support characters as well. And I think maybe that kind of comes a bit from film experience and thinking of these people as fully realised people rather than just kind of ciphers who, you know, just doing stuff because they're doing it because the plot needs it, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really interesting. I mean, I think that's a really valuable point to make, because a lot of people will approach a story where, you know, I've got my main protagonist and antagonist and whatever else, and you know, say it's half a dozen characters that drive the story and everyone else is a cipher. That quickly diminishes the impact on a reader, I think. And indeed, in terms of, you know, film acting, you know, Samuel L. Jackson, when I was briefly subscribed to the Masterclass series of videos, his thing on acting, which was he would never ever go anywhere near a camera without a thought in his, it could be just, what am I going to have for dinner tonight, but he's got to go in on screen as demonstrating that his character is thinking about something.
Yes,
and that is vital, and in a way that's what you need to do with all the characters you create as an author as well.
And it's a very good thought to have
yeah. And definitely. And then also, if you do that, it generates more story ideas as you go along. And if each person that, say, the main character interacts with has their own point of view, then that will, well, more than likely sort of conflict with the main character's point of view. So it gives you a more interesting way rather than just the main character going through, you know, from plot stage to plot stage with too much, that there needs to be friction and micro tension. That's that's something that struck me. I was reading an article about micro tension and how important it is. You have the big arc of the plot and the main struggle of the character.
Yes.
But I think what is interesting is the minor struggles that they can have, and it might just be, as Roz has a bit of a struggle with a colleague that she just doesn't quite see eye to eye with, which kind of is another thing, like a pebble in her shoe, and then that, of course, can feed into the main plot as well. But it gives the thing a texture, I think.
Talking about your film experience, and in a way, being a lawyer in that corporate context is brilliant, because essentially any production is one enormous negotiation all the time. And even on a minor level, when I was doing, you know, even if it was myself going out as a reporter with a cameraman, some guests and an editor back in the office, the level of, you know, to and fro and batting of ideas, and the, you know, your guest has a message they want to get out, but you want to present it in a certain way to make it entertaining for your audience, all of that.
Yeah.
It's writ large on a production, even a small one.
Yeah.
So that must have been, you know, did you find it easy to adapt to?
Yeah, it is. But, you know, people used to say, changing from lawyering to filmmaking, that's a massive change. And you say, in a way, it isn't really, because it's like going from running and negotiating on big projects to doing it on other types of projects. They happen to be more creative, but it's a lot of the same skills. That's definitely right. And you have to, you know, to make a feature film, you have to raise money as well, which involves usually a patchwork from lots of different places and knit it all together into finance agreements. And then you have to contract people, all the people who are working on the production and the actors. Or if you're developing the script and trying to work out what the, you know, there's so many skills like that, or I suppose what you would say are transferable skills from being a lawyer. And then now in writing as well, I find that in on the writing side of things as well, definitely.
It's fascinating. Now, I mean, we ought to, before we get to the random question, mention that you've had an opportunity to have a conversation with Sir Sean Connery. Now, I think you're probably the only person who's ever met him that I've spoken to, because he was quite a difficult person to track down in latter years.
Yes.
But what What was that like?
Well, yes, I met him when I was working in film. The first feature film I worked on was called A Boy Called Dad, which was a young lad of 14 years old who became a dad, as you'd expect, and ended up, for various reasons connected to his relationship with his own dad, ended up stealing the baby and going on the run. And it was screened at the Edinburgh International Film Festival. And it was, when was that? 2009, I think. And they had this thing where Sean Connery was the patron of the head patron of the film festival. And they sort of had this homecoming thing for all these Scots who were all over the place and a big ceilidh in Edinburgh, and Sean Connery was there, and someone said to me, would you like me to introduce you to him? And I said, oh God, no, you know, that's just naff. Like, he probably
it's a cliche, isn't it?
Introducing themselves all the time, and then he's got to, you know, talk. And I said, oh no. And then something kicked in, and I said, no, yeah, please, I would like to talk to him, you know. So I went over, and this person introduced me to him, and he said, hello, Stacey, pleased to meet you, in exactly the way that you would expect. And I thought, well, that's amazing, you know, I can die now. And yeah, he was really charming, actually, and extremely tall. Yeah, he was 80 something, but he was a very imposing man, you know, even given his age. And so it was a great experience. I was glad I did it, although I always think it's a bit naff to approach celebrities, but I thought I'll allow myself this one.
Oh well, I'm so glad you did. I'm now he's passed as well. And of course, you know, his latter years affected by dementia, but they sort of all try to cover up, but eventually time for
the postscript to that story is, sorry, actually, at the time my mum had severe dementia. You know, she's passed away now, and the following day I went to visit her in her in the care home where she was being looked after. And basically by this point she couldn't recognize me, and she didn't know who I was. But when I mentioned Sean Connery, she knew who he was. So, and her eyes lit up. So I thought, wow, that's incredible. But these funny things happen during at those times, although there's a lot of sadness, but there's quite a lot of humour as well with that kind of thing.
Stacey, it's been brilliant to discuss The Thief of Joy and your varied career and how they all sort of intertwine. But at this point, it's the podcast equivalent of the full stop, which is Rebecca's random question.
I've been thinking recently about chairs, right?
Chairs?
We've been watching a program called Salvage Hunters.
Yes.
And the guy in Salvage Hunters is called Drew Pritchard. He runs a sort of an antiques shop warehouse in Colwyn Bay in North Wales. And he goes around grand houses and other antique dealers, and he makes deals and buys furniture to sell in the shop. He's obsessed with chairs. If he sees a chair he likes, he drools and he goes nuts, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
And so I've been thinking about chairs too. And yesterday at the London Book Fair too, there are no chairs to sit on. So again, I was obsessed with chairs. So my question to you is, if you were a chair, what type of chair would you be and why?
That's a good question.
That is a random one.
I think, although I can't see how, I can't see what the psychological significance of this would be, but a sort of leather angular one from East Germany, maybe, you know, those kind of ones that looks quite cool, almost like a Z shape kind of thing that looks like a, And why? I think because I just like the angles. I just think you. I just look at it and think, "Wow, look at that!" You know. Even though, I mean, I live in a house from 1700 and something, so the chair would be completely out of place. It would look absolutely ridiculous. But I don't know. Maybe it's just trying to hold on to that aspect of the metropolis, you know, or something.
So it begs the question, Rebecca. We didn't answer. Well, we did answer during the interview, but it all cut out. Mm. Chairs.
Chairs. Yes. So, what chair would I be?
Yeah. Would you be? Yeah. I guess. Yeah.
It was. It was. If you were a chair. So my answer. Well, as many chairs I'd like to be, but one is a school chemistry lab chair from the 80s.
A stool,
or previously.
Yeah.
Stool, yes.
With all the chewing gum underneath it. And
the graffiti and the, you know, where you used to scratch it with the scalpel and all that sort of thing. Partly because we've been watching a programme called Salvage Hunters, and I think we talked about this on the podcast before. It's on Discovery Plus, and it's just one of those long-running shows. It's the same format every time, and it's this guy called Drew Pritchard, who owns an antique shop in North Wales, and he goes around the country with his mate T, buying antiques and things that people don't want anymore from schools and country houses and all sorts of places, and he sells them in the shop. Anyway, he gets obsessed with chairs. He sees a chair and he goes, "Oh my god, that's beautiful! I've got to have that chair." And he turns it upside down and he examines it and makes a deal. And so I've been thinking a lot about chairs, which is where the question came from. And he gets obsessed with these chemistry lab chairs he finds in these private schools. And I used to love that chair. I remember sort of sitting on it at school, you know, elbows on the lab bench and so I would be a chemistry chair, or my other choice is a rocking chair, because you get to hug people when they sit in it, and that's
we've got a rocking chair just in front of us as we speak, which I haven't used yet. You know,
you've not sat in it at all?
No, not once.
Oh,
it's crazy, isn't it?
That is crazy.
And I suggested that I would like to be, this is slightly icky, the chair that Jimmy Savile used to use on Jimmy Savile, you know, on the Jim Will Fix It, which used to magically open up, the arms would open up, or, you know, it was all that sort of 1970s high fidelity, you know, engineering. And out would come his lit cigar, a cup of tea, Jim Will Fix It badges. I just want to have the ease of having it all there. Now, admittedly, there are things like Lazy Boy armchairs now that have a lot of these functions built in. But it was revolutionary in the 70s, and it was a bespoke piece of furniture that the BBC prop team built.
I think this is a chair you want, though, not a chair you would personally be.
No, I don't think I'd be. No, I think I'd probably be a well-worn leather club chair.
Yes, I could see you as
sort of sit there with a glass of whiskey and sort of pontificating about how rotten life is.
Oh yes, that is so you.
Yeah, but it is.
But I do think you need a Jimmy Savile chair, because we have a pink chair in the farmhouse, not the farmhouse, gosh, we haven't lived there for you.
In the barn.
In the barn, and you sit there and you watch sport normally.
Yes.
But there's always a little trails of evidence that you've been there afterwards. For example, shells of nuts. Yeah. Empty crisp packets.
My friends and I of old, that I used to sit when I was in my 20s in my chair on days off, and I would barely get dressed. I'd be in my pyjamas, basically, with cans of beer and cashew nuts.
Yeah. You haven't changed that much.
No, I haven't.
The beer has changed to cups of coffee.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Or glasses of bitter lemon. But that's
the other thing, glasses. And then your shoes, often shoes are there,
right.
And that drives me potty.
Yeah, I know, I know, I know. I'm a creature of habit in that regard.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much to Stacey for joining us, and for her forbearance with a Zoom call that dropped out about six times.
At least.
But we have our guest next week is the brilliant Tim Malini.
Yes, so we did that interview a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? But it's brilliant.
He is a terrific author, sort of humorous thriller writer in a way.
Yeah.
But We didn't actually explore this, but he has an amazing business career as well. But we stuck to the writing.
I'm quite glad we didn't, actually.
Yeah. In some ways. But anyway, he joins us from New Jersey next week, and really pleased with that interview. So look forward to that. We ought to just sort of round up the week that we did. We were down in Dorset, and we are members of the Ackroyd publishing team, alongside everything else that we do in our lives. And that is to say, we work with Rachel McLean, who is one of the UK's top selling crime writers at the moment, independently based. And we're part of a team of seven people now, alongside Rachel, who are taking her books into new territories and new formats and all sorts of things going on. Very, very honoured to be part of that team. And she took us down to Wareham in Dorset and a visit to Corfe Castle. And then we went across on the pool, chain ferry and things like that.
Because I paddled.
That's where her principal series, the Dorset crime series, has been based. And she felt it an appropriate place. We had an event with 40 readers, full house. It was a balloon debate. Which characters should get, thrown off the side to try and save the others. And it was a really valuable couple of days, actually. Mm. Done a lot of travelling this week, but we've got a lot out of it. Back to the day job, but full of fresh ideas and fresh impetus.
Yes, but quite tired.
Yeah, very, very tired. We're not used to it. But it's been a very valuable week. And I hope that this show has been to your liking. If it has and you haven't subscribed yet, please subscribe to the Hobcast Book Show wherever you get your podcasts from. Take a look at our website, www.hobeck.net, in its current form before it changes significantly in the next few months as we adjust to selling direct. But from myself, Adrian Hobart.
And myself, Rebecca Collins, and upside down Tinkerbell over there.
The cat is on the other sofa. We'd like to thank you for joining us, and we wish you a wonderful and
creative
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.